This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, this summer will mark 2 years since the state budget impasse ended. The effects are still being felt. We'll hear from a mental health service provider. We'll also tell you about the continuing effort to expand insurance coverage for autism treatment. Problems on interstate highways and bridges get a lot of attention, but you may be seeing potholes and cracks in other roads as counties and townships are struggling to maintain them.
We do need to remind ourselves that we have fallen 10 or more years behind on just basic maintenance of our existing infrastructure.
Electric cars are gradually gaining market share. That means the demand for ethanol could start to fall, and that might put corn farmers in a tough spot. Also, we begin our look at video gambling in Illinois. It was promoted as a way to raise large amounts of revenue for the state. Has it lived up to its billing? That and more this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, electric vehicles are becoming more common. There are definitely environmental advantages to driving them, but what does it mean for the future of ethanol and the farmers who supply the corn for the fuel? We'll also find out about efforts to expand insurance coverage for autism treatment, and we'll hear more about an investigation into video gambling in Illinois. That and more coming up on this week's Statewide. First up today, problems on interstate highways and bridges get a lot of attention, but you may be seeing more potholes and cracks on the roads you take to work or even live on. Counties and townships are struggling to maintain them, and county engineers say without more money for basic maintenance, they could be getting worse. Mary Hansen has our Illinois Issues report.
Brian Otten has a triage system.
Somebody will come in and they'll say, hey, we got potholes. Hey, we got a fallen-in pipe.
He's the highway engineer in Perry County in southern Illinois.
And then we'll go out and look at both of them and go, okay, well, this pipe's about ready to fall in, and somebody could have an accident here and really get hurt. That takes precedence over the inconvenience of a pothole.
Otten oversees about 500 miles of roads that connect people to work or the grocery store and rural routes that may have just a couple of houses on them. And he says despite doing what the county can afford for maintenance, the roads are getting worse.
They can't seem to handle some of the traffic loads that are on them. They don't have enough structure underneath of them. They're busting up on us. And we're having a hard time keeping them glued together.
It's happening all over the state, according to Craig Fink, an engineer with Tazewell County and former president of the Illinois Association of County Engineers. An analysis from the Engineers Association shows this year nearly half of their roads will suffer from some form of neglect.
They will not be getting the most basic preservation and protective type of maintenance they need to avoid eventually just going back to gravel or earth and mud.
That's more than double the bad roads from 5 years ago. So how did we get here? Counties and townships are responsible for a huge share of Illinois roads, roughly 89,000 miles. To keep them up, local governments get a piece of what you pay for gasoline and what their residents pay in property taxes. And Fink says because of more fuel-efficient cars and people driving less, money from the gas tax is now below what it was in 2000.
That is in real dollars, so that's not an inflationary adjusted figure. I'm saying that the gross amount today is less.
Bigger cities like Springfield and Peoria can use money from sales or video gambling or hotel taxes to keep up with construction costs. But smaller towns can't. The county engineers say counties, townships, and road districts need about $650 million more dollars a year to properly maintain their roads, to keep those roads from, in Fink's words, dying.
So this isn't widening roads out, giving them structural overlays, or certainly not laying out any new roads. This is all about just, are we able to preserve and protect with proper maintenance what we have?
The request comes as Illinois lawmakers are beginning to negotiate an infrastructure plan. In general, state lawmakers agree on two essential points about the plan. One, it's sorely needed. And two, it will take more tax money to pay for it. How much money, what it will pay for, and where the money will come from are still up for debate. State Representative Ryan Spain is a Republican from Peoria and on the House committee that's hearing all about the needs for improvements to transportation, education, and state facilities. He says he supports local roads getting a bigger piece of new transportation funding.
We do need to remind ourselves that we have fallen 10 or more years behind on just basic maintenance of our existing infrastructure. And so catching up on that existing infrastructure needs to be a top priority.
Still, others are more hesitant. State Senator Don DeWitt represents the Northwest Chicago suburbs and is the highest-ranking Republican on the Senate Transportation Committee. He says a priority needs to be long-term investments.
Roads and bridges that we can't continue to dump, you know, millions and millions of dollars in over the years and just general maintenance when what they really need is to be totally rebuilt and reconstructed.
Governor J.B. Pritzker has said he wants an infrastructure plan approved this spring. So lawmakers have a few months to figure out how much money to spend to keep what we have and how much should be spent on new investments. I'm Mary Hansen.
You can read Mary's full report. It's available at our website, statewideshow.com. For months, member station WBEZ and ProPublica Illinois have been looking at the effects of the last great gambling expansion in the state, which happened about a decade ago. The state bet big on video gambling, but it's worked out better for the gambling industry than for taxpayers. Over $1 billion, lawmakers predicted, would fill state coffers has failed to materialize. So should we be doing it again? Reporters Jason Grotto, Sandhya Kambupati of ProPublica Illinois, and WBEZ's Dan Mahalopoulos have been on the story, and they recently talked with Jen White of WBEZ about their work.
Well, Dan, this investigation focuses on video gambling. Explain what that is and how it got so big in Illinois.
So video gambling is often called video poker or electronic slot machines, and it's basically a Chuck E. Cheese for adults. These look just like any other video games, except they're games of chance. You can bet on them, and they're designed to make it so that you'll keep playing. You know, they have chairs sometimes that are made out of a material that's used by NASA. That even the patents themselves, which we looked at, say quite clearly that you can sit in these chairs for hours and hours without losing circulation to your legs. And of course, they're trying to get you to spend and lose as much money as you can. Before, we had gambling already at casinos, but after video gambling was approved in 2009 in Springfield, you could have up to 5 of these machines in any place that serves liquor. So it's been an enormous change. It's exponentially more places where you can gamble. We've gone from, 10 casinos to thousands and thousands of places where you can place a bet now.
Jason, are these gambling machines concentrated in certain areas?
No, in fact, they're spread out all over the state. The only area that does not have them currently, significant area, is the city of Chicago, which has a 100-year-old ordinance that bars any kind of gambling.
Sandhya, talk about the planning that went into this expansion of video gambling. How did it all come together?
Yeah, so it was basically no planning. It was talked about for years and years, and then they did it within 48 hours. In fact, the legislation was written by the gambling industry. And the Illinois Gaming Board, the agency that regulates video gambling, they didn't even know it was coming. And the governor at the time, Pat Quinn, had said he had opposed it, but then he signed it. And it got approved with the promise of bringing in big revenues for the state. And we found that that didn't happen.
Well, Jason, as we mentioned, this hasn't been the financial boon. It was meant to be for the state of Illinois. Break down the numbers for us.
Well, I mean, first of all, I think it's important to realize that Illinois now has nearly 7,000 video gambling locations, which means we have more places to make a bet than Nevada. 30,000 video gambling machines in total. And as Sandhya was saying, you know, originally the legislature had said that these machines would bring in $300 million a year starting in 2010. Well, it wasn't until 2017 that that didn't happen, or that that happened. In the meantime, the state started borrowing billions of dollars before the revenues from video gambling came in. And so it's really a cautionary tale about, you know, counting on revenues before they come in, certainly with these vice types of revenue, that they take a long time to come in. There's also costs associated with them. So while the revenue didn't come in while we were borrowing, the way the law was structured left huge funding gaps in the regulatory realm as well as social costs.
Dan, as part of your reporting, you visited a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in Downers Grove, and that's where you met a woman named Anne. She only wanted to go by her first name.
Because you have these machines coming up all over the place, you're going to have people that never thought they had an addiction all of a sudden having addictions, and there's nowhere for them to go. There's no help for them. There's no monies for them.
So you have the fiscal fallout from this gambling plan, but what does Ann's story tell us about some of the costs to society?
Yeah, well, it only stands to reason that when you have more places to gamble, you're going to have people who are prone to addiction more likely to get drawn in and indeed become addicted. And that's exactly what the social service agencies and the Gamblers Anonymous people are telling us is happening, that we have more and more addicts in this state. I talked to one guy together with Jason down in Decatur named Orville, who told us that he had beaten other addictions, very serious addictions, smoking, drinking, rather readily, and just could not quit gambling. Lost tens of thousands of dollars and just could not quit, because we're finding, and we talked to experts who said, this is really a disease. It used to be classified as some sort of lack of impulse control, like a kleptomania, for instance. And it's now classified together with alcoholism and drug addiction, because it really does change the wiring of your brain, literally.
That's WBEZ politics reporter Dan Mihalopoulos. Also with us, ProPublica Illinois reporter Jason Grotto and ProPublica's Sandhya Kambampati. Sandhya, you really hone in on gambling addiction, and you looked into whether the state of Illinois, when it expanded gambling, was fully prepared for the increase in addiction. What did you find?
Well, actually, we found that Illinois is not prepared for funding this. The state actually spends less money today on problem gambling than before video gambling was approved. And what's worse than that is, unlike other states, Illinois doesn't have any research or any kind of studies to really understand how big the problem is. And we've looked at locations all around the state and kind of the demographics of these areas, and we found that these machines are in areas that are lower income areas. So it's really targeting vulnerable population.
Jason, what would it take to change video gambling in Illinois at this point?
Well, look, I think, you know, first of all, it's important to point out that two of the four legislative leaders who were in the room when this put together, or when they put this legislation together, now say that the state, this was a bad idea, that the state needs to go back and take a second look at this. I think some of the first things that would need to be done is to look at, should there be a cap on the number of machines? Currently, there is no cap. They can just keep putting machines online. Second, I think the state needs to look hard at the tax rates. Our research found that Illinois has some of the lowest tax rates for video gambling. You know, Pennsylvania, which just legalized video gambling, the tax rate's 52%. South Dakota and West Virginia, it's at 50. Oregon, it's at 70. Here, the state gets 25%, and local governments only get 5%, even though they're shouldering the burden of whatever social costs are out there. The second thing is to look at the fees and the administrative licensing fees and other things, because right now those fees are supposed to cover regulatory and social costs, and the fact is they don't. The state records that we looked at from the comptroller's office show that it costs about $17, $18 million a year at least to regulate video gambling, but those fees bring in just $3, $4 million a year. So we have a huge funding shortfall there. In fact, the chairman of the gaming board, during an interview with us, said that the state should commission a professional study to examine all of these issues. And in fact, he's proposed that.
Do you think there's political will to look into this issue?
That's the question that remains to be seen. I mean, right now, I believe the governor has been on record, as well as numerous lawmakers and leadership and otherwise, who really see gambling in general as an easy way to solve the state's financial issues, or at least to help the state's financial issues. You don't have to raise taxes per se, and you don't have to cut spending. In fact, though, this is really a regressive tax on the people who play the games.
Dan, what is the relationship like between the gambling industry and lawmakers? How much influence does that industry have on what's happening in Springfield?
So they're very tight, Springfield and the gambling industry. In fact, Jason and I traveled to Las Vegas to the gambling industry's national conference last fall, and we found a bunch of legislators enjoying dinner on the industry's dime and other parties that the industry put on for them. One of the places we went up to some of these guys from Illinois was a restaurant in Las Vegas that had been in the movie Casino. Mm-hmm. Remember that Robert De Niro movie?
Of course.
And we ran into none other than Joe Berrios, the former Cook County assessor. He just lost that job, and he just lost his job as the Cook County Democratic Party's chairman But again, now he's a lobbyist for the video gambling industry. And this is what he told us.
Do you guys have a dinner with a group of legislators pretty much every year at this conference for some years now?
Yeah, we invite legislators down to come and see, you know, what actually is going on with the industry.
Do you think it might create the perception that they're too close, maybe, to the industry?
You know, we don't pay their way down here. They come down here, we take them to dinner, but that's about it.
And Berrios told us that he's bullish about the future of the industry. He feels they bring a lot of money to the state, and they hope to be able to have more than five machines at every location, which is the cap right now. And they're also looking at more casinos, maybe a Chicago casino, sports betting, and that's all on the table when they come back to Springfield.
Jason, with gambling bubbling up as a possible solution to some of the state's fiscal woes, what effect do you hope this work has?
Well, I think on the gambling issue, as well as the movement to legalize marijuana, it's not so much whether it should or shouldn't be done as much as the state moves forward. You know, before any moves are made, the state really needs to take a step back and look closely. What are the regulatory costs? What are the inevitable social costs? How do we roll these things out responsibly so that the state can take whatever financial benefit that these industries may bring to the state, while also making sure that the costs that are going to be associated with them are covered?
We've been speaking with ProPublica Illinois' Jason Grotto and Sandhya Kambampati and WBEZ's Dan Mihalopoulos about their investigation into video gambling here in Illinois. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And coming up next week on Statewide, we'll hear more from the reporters who are investigating video gambling's effects in the state of Illinois, and we'll hear from gambling addicts and whether or not the state is watching the impact of video gambling. You can find a link to all the reporting in this series from WBEZ and ProPublica Illinois. The link is at our website at statewideshow.com. Ahead, electric vehicles and the impact in corn country. We're back on Statewide. Just ahead, mental health service providers in Illinois are still trying to rebound following the two-year budget impasse. We'll hear an interview and what needs to be done to help homeless kids in Illinois. That and more coming up on Statewide. Each year, about 40% of the corn grown in the U.S. gets turned into ethanol for gasoline, but the demand to reduce fossil fuel emissions has drivers turning to electric cars. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer looks at how that may impact the Corn Belt.
So there's your first one. It's going to do it again.
Kevin Caldwell is demonstrating the hands-free feature of the all-electric Nissan Leaf.
So now it wants to completely stop because it thinks you're asleep at the wheel and you don't.
Aside from this nearly autonomous option, Caldwell says driving a Leaf is basically the same as driving a typical gasoline or gas-electric hybrid car, except you plug it in rather than pumping gas into it. Last year, 1 million electric cars were sold nationwide. As a manager at Hummel's Nissan in Des Moines, Caldwell says 25% to 30% of his Leaf customers are farmers. Like the others, they fall into two categories.
The customers that are more environmentally conscious and they want to lower their carbon footprint, versus the customer that is simply wanting to not have to worry about gas prices.
Lee Tesdell is all in for reducing his carbon footprint. He owns a farm in Polk County, Iowa, where in 2013 he began installing solar panels.
And all the time I was thinking that I would like to also drive an electric car so that my solar electrical production would be part of the fuel for my electric car.
In December, he bought an all-electric Chevy Bolt for his commute. On the farm, he has a variety of conservation practices in place, raises sheep and grows alfalfa. He also has dozens of acres he rents out to a farmer who plants corn and soybeans. Ethanol has been a boon to corn farmers, but Tesdale says it's led to overproduction, which in turn has kept corn prices low the past several years.
I would like to see corn acres reduced by quite a lot in Iowa and more diversification.
And that could help farmers in two ways. Trevor Russell of the Friends of the Mississippi River Environmental Group says, first, diversifying would help farmers make the transition away from corn. And secondly, different crops like Kernza wheat or the oilseed camelina could help clean up polluted waterways and nurture depleted soils.
Let's not be left holding the ball on 40% of our corn crop that doesn't have a market and can't get sold anywhere. That would be an economic catastrophe for farmers and for rural communities.
But Russell says it's going to take the same types of government policies and incentives that expanded ethanol to establish viable markets for other crops. Farmers may not have much time to spare as the transition to electric cars is well underway.
Retooling our cropping systems to respond to that is going to take longer than the transition to electric vehicles will take. So we need to start yesterday.
But John Eichberger of the Washington, D.C.-based Fuels Institute says it's not time for the ethanol industry to panic yet.
We have people thinking, well, it's going to be electric or it's going to be liquid. It's probably going to be a combination for a long time because we're not going to transition 100%.
That's something Rand Faberg well knows. He commutes to his job as a welder in Ames, Iowa, in this 2012 Nissan Leaf that he bought used. He charges it in a barn on his farm where he raises hogs and cattle.
I have several trucks, cars, tractors. I still use a lot of gas, but electric is the way to go. And electric will overtake all the automobiles very shortly. I'm convinced of that.
And do you think that will be bad for your friends and neighbors who farm?
No. Overall, farmers can adapt. So I think it'll be good for everybody.
Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Students at Northern Illinois University are helping the federal government research when and where it's too icy for planes to fly. Chase Cavanaugh has an update on that.
When people hear the word meteorology, the first thing that often comes to mind is TV weathermen. A key aspect of meteorology is studying atmospheric patterns to accurately predict the weather, but NIU professor Victor Gensini says there is much more to the field.
After you get a meteorology degree, you're a broadly trained critical thinker. You have skills in physics and mathematics and computer science and programming.
This versatility is one reason why the National Center for Atmospheric Research reached out to Gensini's department about a cold weather study.
They knew we had a meteorology program and said, hey, are you guys interested in participating in this icicle field campaign? And I think it was one of those emails where it's immediately a yes. How can we help?
Icicle is short for in-cloud icing and large drop experiment. An airplane flies out of Rockford to scan the skies around Great Lakes and Plains states. Its instruments scan for locations where ice is likely to form on other aircraft. But NCAR needs to know when the sky will be cold enough to get the most out of the plane's instruments. To get these readings, they call people like NIU graduate student Cody Converse.
And then we put together a team of undergraduate students and ourselves to go perform a launch for the request.
Converse says each balloon has an instrument at the bottom called a radio sonde.
As the balloon rises through the atmosphere, that little radio sonde takes measurements every, I think we have it set to 10 seconds for the launches that we do. And then we read in all those data, and then using the GPS coordinates, we can track not only the location of the radio sonde, but we can calculate the wind speed and the wind direction with altitude.
NCAR is sent these radio sonde readings, which it then uses to plot a course for their research airplane. NIU is one of several universities launching these balloons, but a doctoral student, Robert Fritzen, thinks their data is given a bit more weight due to DeKalb's close location. The project is overseen by the professor, his graduate students, and about 16 undergrads. Fritzen says participation in Icicle helps spur him to dive even deeper into his subject.
I've always had a fascination with weather, and then when I came to graduate school, I got to actually do a research project on the weather, and I've been hooked to it ever since, like this researching new phenomena, understanding the things we don't know about the atmosphere. I want to dig deeper.
Gensini says NIU is the oldest university in the state that offers a meteorology specialization, and the only one north of Interstate 80. He says many graduates move on to broadcast work, join the National Weather Service, or conduct studies at national labs. But Gensini says that's far from the only career option available.
A lot of them go to the private sector and work for either startup firms or firms like insurance companies and reinsurance companies that are focused on things like catastrophe modeling.
Gensini says meteorology majors studying extreme weather events can also share a common passion as researchers or excitable weather forecasters.
It's like being a little kid at Christmas, you know, watching the weather observations come in when we get those sort of events.
NCAR wraps up the icicle study March 6th, and will use its findings to determine safe times for planes to fly in the winter. But Professor Gensini says there will always be a need for meteorological expertise.
Every time we walk out the door, we go outside, we're all being influenced by weather, right? And so I think companies are seeing the importance of hiring meteorologists, and that's why I think they'll continue to be in demand as we go forward the next 15, 20 years.
He says that will continue to be true with the increased focus on global warming. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
This is Statewide. During the two-year budget impasse, many mental health service providers were forced to close their doors or cut back on services. And now advocates want to bring back the focus to treatment and increase funding. Our reporter Daisy Contreras spoke to Heather O'Donnell of Thresholds. That's a Chicago-based mental health service provider. She explains the need for mental health funding in the state.
Illinois really ranks at the bottom of other states nationally in terms of mental health funding. We simply have just not invested in the right kinds of treatment and the right kinds of services for people to enable them to get the treatment they need. Only about a third of people that have a mental health need are able to get treatment. And we saw over the last 4 years that this situation was exacerbated by the budget impasse. I believe that about 86% of mental health providers were forced to reduce or eliminate psychiatric services, and nearly half of providers had to cut services or shut down programs. So we're not in a good place in terms of how we treat people with mental health conditions in Illinois.
Who was the hardest hit by the cutbacks during the budget impasse?
I think people that were the hardest hit are the people that actually have mental health conditions. We have a severe problem with children who have significant mental health conditions in Illinois and not being able to access treatment. We have children that are actually ready for discharge in psychiatric hospitals that their families can't find treatment placements for them. So they can't find a residential treatment placement, or they can't find the right kind of psychiatrist or therapist to help with follow-up treatment. And so they actually are forced to remain in hospitals far, far longer than what is necessary, which just exacerbates their condition and puts an enormous strain on the family. So I think it's really the people that need the treatment services that were the hardest hit.
Currently, how much does the state invest in mental health treatment?
I believe it is over about $200 million. But when you think about the fact that we have over 12.8 million people in the state, and we have 2.5 million people that need mental health treatment, but only about a third can get it, that's simply not enough.
This legislative session, there are some proposals that would help with this issue. Can you tell me more about what they would do?
Yes. One of the bills that is before the General Assembly is called the Mental Health Modernization Act. These would ramp up mental health funding over a 3- and 4-year period to increase access to psychiatry services, therapy services, community mental health services, and would also modernize and incentivize how mental health services are delivered and enable services that deliver the best health outcomes. So this would be a really, really significant step forward for the state of Illinois, and is absolutely crucial if we are going to rebuild our mental health system. And there's also another bill that is a children's mental health crisis bill that would beef up children's mental health as well.
Where would the money come from?
Well, there are a lot of different revenue proposals on the table. We would argue that community mental health treatment is far, far cheaper than hospitalization. It is 33 times less expensive than a hospitalization and far cheaper than jails that have become the new de facto mental health facilities. So we hope that as the governor and legislators are looking at the different new revenue proposals on the table, that they would dedicate a portion of this revenue to these proposals. But the proposal that I mentioned before, the Mental Health Modernization Act, it was actually designed to minimize the fiscal impact to the state. So it slowly ramps up funding, and in the first year would only cost the state $3.4 million. And over a four-year period, the most funding it would cost in one fiscal year is $13 million. So this is not a huge fiscal hit to the state, but is absolutely necessary to the citizens of Illinois.
Governor Pritzker put in some money for mental health services in his budget proposal. How much did he put in there, and would that be enough?
Well, we're still analyzing the exact dollar amount of the increased investment in mental health, but there is increased investment in some pilot programs around some Medicaid, some new Medicaid pilots that are in the infancy stages, care integration between mental health and primary care. So there's a lot of good things in his budget, and we are encouraged that he mentioned it in his budget address and making it a priority. It was also a priority in his campaign. He actually had a campaign commercial on it. So we hope that this is the start of significant investment over time as the state rights its financial ship.
For Statewide, I'm Daisy Contreras. I'm joined by Heather O'Donnell, Senior Vice President of Public Policy and Advocacy at Thresholds. Thresholds is a provider of mental health services in the Chicagoland area. Heather, can you maybe just walk me through an ideal process of treatment for someone seeking services?
Mm-hmm. Well, for instance, if you have a child that maybe your child has some signs of depression, so the options would be maybe making an appointment with a therapist or a psychiatrist. And if the child needs more significant attention at that point, if those avenues are not working, under the public sector, there are multidisciplinary team-based treatment models that provide more social work services, crisis-based services, and things like that. There's also residential treatment if a child has very high needs, but these types of services are very, very limited. We have a national psychiatrist shortage, and in Illinois, we pay psychiatrists such a low rate of reimbursement that the psychiatrists that we do have in Illinois, many of them simply can't afford to participate in the Medicaid program because they lose money providing those services. And a place like Thresholds actually has a very hard time finding psychiatrists because of limited funding. And this bill would actually address some of that by increasing the rate for psychiatrists that are paid through the Medicaid program, so it would leverage the psychiatrists that we do have. It would also leverage other mental health professionals like psychiatric advanced practice nurses and funding for team-based treatment models, which are more of a wraparound treatment approach.
Do you think these proposals would have been difficult or not possible under the previous administration?
I think they would have been a non-starter under the previous administration. Proposals for new spending were just not really considered under Governor Rauner. I do hope that our new governor, Governor Pritzker, will seriously, and his administration will seriously consider supporting these or a version of these bills, because it's unconscionable how we treat children and adults that have significant mental health needs. We should treat these conditions for what they are. They're common medical conditions. They're treatable when people get treatment. The problem is that we don't enable treatment at an early stage. And the people that are able to get treatment are the lucky ones. But we have tens of thousands of children and adults that simply go without treatment, and they wind up in the criminal justice system because they spiral into multiple mental health crises. They wind up in hospitals. They wind up on street corners. It's not the way we should treat these conditions as a society. And it also makes financial sense. So both the social justice component is there as well as the finances.
So overall, it's costing the state more now. It's going to be cheaper down the road if we actually put in some investment.
Yes. It costs about $28 a day to provide community-based mental health services, and this is compared to nearly $1,000 a day for a hospitalization or $190 a day for the cost of jail. So it absolutely makes financial sense. It just takes political will.
Heather, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Heather O'Donnell of Thresholds, a Chicago-based mental health service provider, talking with our reporter, Daisy Contreras. You're listening to Statewide. There is more to come. We'll hear about efforts to expand coverage for treatment of autism. That's ahead. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, in Illinois, school districts can use their own money to pay for housing assistance. One parent says she never would have been able to find a home without the help.
I'd probably still be living in the hotels, or God knows, I'd probably be out on the streets or in a shelter somewhere.
Why schools are helping homeless kids find housing and the limits of what districts can do. That story just ahead. Up next, a story of love and loss, grief and healing, is told through music in a newly written symphony. That piece was started by a world-renowned composer and finished by his son. Rich Egger has the story.
The composer is David Maslanka. He made a name for himself with works such as A Child's Garden of Dreams. Audiences are less likely to be familiar with Maslanka's Symphony No. 10. That's because it's a new composition. Its world premiere was given in April of last year. Its Illinois premiere is being performed by the Western Illinois University Wind Ensemble.
I think it needs to be a little stronger than that.
That's Western's director of bands, Mike Fansler, during a recent rehearsal. He says Western and several other schools commissioned Maslanka a few years ago to write the new symphony. Fansler says it took a while to complete the work. For one thing,
he was a very introspective and contemplative composer, and he would take time to write, and he would go into deep meditation to seek musical ideas or thoughts or direction for his works.
Fansler says Maslanka completed sketches for several movements. Then his wife Allison became terminally ill. That altered Maslanka's approach to the composition. The first movement became a love song for his dying wife.
It's just a beautiful melody, and that's the way he went with that, even though the weight and magnitude of this death was happening in his life.
Is he perhaps celebrating the life rather than mourning the loss?
Exactly. And you know, I told the band that, and you know, some of the kids had tears in their eyes just thinking about it.
Shortly thereafter, Maslanka received more gut-wrenching news. He was diagnosed with stage 4 colon cancer. Knowing his time might be limited, he turned to his son Matthew to help him finish the symphony. Matthew plays the euphonium and is also a composer. Matthew says his mother died in early July of 2017. His father's health took a quick turn for the worse, and he passed away about a month later. Though filled with grief, Matthew knew he had to keep working to complete his father's final symphony.
This piece needed to happen now. And if I waited now, I would wait forever. If I put it aside, it was going to be a weight around my soul for the rest of my life.
So Matthew canceled everything else in his life and poured his heart and soul into finishing the symphony. He orchestrated sections that were in final form. He expanded parts that were fragmentary.
It's not how he would have finished this music, but it's a combination of his spirit and mine.
Matthew says the project stretched him to his limit, both technically and emotionally. Matthew Maslanka says you're not done with grief until it's done with you. And he says the symphony's third movement reflects that as the music becomes more and more distressed.
With the euphonium shrieking out into the darkness at the end of the movement as the world kind of uncaringly rolls along behind it.
The Maslanka Symphony No. 10 is subtitled The River of Time, a title the elder Maslanka came up with. There's a cliché, time heals all wounds, and Matthew Maslanka says the fourth and final movement of The River of Time is a balm on the open wound expressed in the third movement. The fourth movement includes chorales written by his father. They bring the symphony to a peaceful conclusion.
And in my mind, this is him at work. Getting ready to write the next thing.
That story produced by Rich Egger, the Illinois premiere of the Symphony No. 10 was last weekend. It was performed by Western Illinois University's Wind Ensemble. Approximately 1 in 59 children is diagnosed with autism in the U.S. A decade ago, Illinois started requiring private insurers to cover autism treatment. It was a hard-fought battle, but the signing of the legislation was overshadowed by other headlines. Jacqueline Driscoll has more on how advocates are still fighting to expand that coverage.
When Illinoisans think back to December of 2008, typically they remember this.
We begin this hour with breaking news. Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich has been taken into federal custody.
Then Attorney General Lisa Madigan quickly asked the courts to strip the governor of his powers.
I recognize that this is an extraordinary request, but these are extraordinary circumstances.
But in typical Blagojevich fashion, the governor flexed a little muscle to signal he wasn't going down without a fight. You might remember hearing he signed a bill the day after his arrest. That was Brianna's Law, which expanded autism coverage for children in the state. Politically, anything that helps kids is usually a good move. But with the governor being the center of an FBI investigation, the law became just a mention in news stories. In this story, though, it's a bit more important. The inspiration behind the legislation was a 5-year-old named Brianna DeCieni, or Bree for short, who had been diagnosed with autism. Her father, Paul, worked for months with legislators to see it signed into law. Fast forward more than a decade, and Paul is back in the state house, still fighting to expand coverage for autism. He told lawmakers recently.
2003, we were blessed with a beautiful little redheaded, blue-eyed girl by the name of Brianna. As she was developing, she wasn't talking. She wasn't making eye contact. She wasn't social. And my wife's a nurse, and she said, you know, something's not right. And we started getting her help through early intervention.
Bree's family was financially better off than most, and they could afford treatment, but it still wasn't cheap.
We realized at that point that it was going to be an expensive life because it was about $3,000 to $4,000 a month that we were going out of pocket.
Paul said his dad pushed him to make a change that would help other families struggling to pay for the expensive treatment, which birthed the idea of Brianna's Law. It did expand coverage, but not for children on Medicaid.
All children in Illinois should have this opportunity, not just those with private insurance coverage.
That's Lee Grannon, a board-certified behavior analyst who has practiced applied behavior analysis therapy for close to 16 years. ABA therapy is an evidence-based treatment for children with autism. Research shows it's the best form of early intervention. Illinois is one of only 8 states that does not mandate Medicaid to cover ABA therapy. Grannon talked about a child named Chase. When she began working with him, he was 3 years old. He didn't talk and refused to play with other kids. With that behavior, he likely wouldn't be allowed in a regular classroom setting.
With hard work and therapy for 2 years and strong family support, Chase scored in the typical range for kindergarten readiness, language, and intellectual ability. He was able to start kindergarten in the general education classroom.
But this therapy is expensive. Out of pocket, it costs about $2,000 per week. And if Illinois does mandate Medicaid coverage, Rough estimates show that it could cost the state about $10,000 per child per year. But advocates say this is an investment. Early intervention would lower costs for adult care down the road and lost productivity from people with autism. They say it could end up saving the state about $3 million. As for Bree, Paul says she's a perfect example of what ABA therapy can do.
She plays hockey with the boys. She has two girls on her team at the YMCA. She plays girls softball. She's all A's. This kid has the ability, and these kids do have the ability to succeed if they get this early intervention and behavioral therapy like ABA that gets them out of their bad habits.
She's now 16 years old, on the high honor roll, and no longer requires therapy. I'm Jacqueline Driscoll.
This is Statewide. There are more than 50,000 homeless students in Illinois. That's according to data from the Illinois State Board of Education. One school district in suburban Cook County used a little-known state law to help two homeless families find a place to live. But even advocates of the workaround acknowledge it's only going to help a fraction of homeless families. For Illinois Newsroom, Lee Gaines brings us the story of one of them.
Last summer, Chantille was forced to leave the home she shared with her two daughters and her mother in Des Plaines. The landlord was selling the building. We're not using Chantille's last name to protect her family's privacy. Landlords refused to rent to Chantille because of her credit score and her income. She makes $12 an hour at a department store. Moving day came, and they had no place to go.
August 1st, we were into the hotels. Living in the hotels was something I wouldn't wish on anybody.
Chantille and her family spent 2.5 months living in hotels. They lived in a single room without a kitchen. At first, Chantille drove her oldest daughter from the hotel to her school. She packed her car with all of their belongings because she was never sure where they'd be staying that night. And that's how the principal of her daughter's school discovered she was homeless.
He saw all of my things in the car and he spazzed out. He never saw me that way before. He was like, what's going on? You know, talk to me, open up.
Chantille did open up, even though she was scared to tell school staff what was happening for fear her kids may be taken away. Instead, the school helped get the family into a home. And that's thanks to a 2017 state law. The idea behind the law is to house families and save school districts money. Federal law requires that schools pay for transporting homeless kids back and forth to their original school district. When they live far away, in a hotel or a shelter, it can cost schools a lot of money. This new state law lets schools pay for a few months' rent for homeless families instead.
It saves the district money, and in the end, it saves all Illinoisans' money, so everyone wins, especially the kids.
That's Sean Schleiser. He's the associate superintendent of East Main School District 63. Housing advocates I talked to in the state say his district is the only one that's actually used the law to help homeless families. So far, they've assisted two, including Chantille's. In Chantille's case, that was $1,500 to cover most of her first month's rent. And for Chantille, a home means more than just a roof over their heads. Her kids have their own rooms. Photos of relatives line the walls.
So my dining room has like a lot of pictures on the wall. It's considered our family room. We look back at the time that we have spent with family, which is what it says on our wall. Time spent with family is worth every second.
Schleiser, the superintendent, says it was clear she wouldn't have been able to find a place without the district's help. Chantille agrees.
I'd probably still be living in the hotels, or God knows, I'd probably be out on the streets or in a shelter somewhere. And the superintendent, if I ever meet that guy, I'll probably give him a big kiss on the cheek.
But this law isn't going to help most of Illinois' homeless students. And that's because it doesn't get at the root cause of homelessness for families. Christina Endrice with the National Center for Homeless Education explains.
We definitely don't have enough affordable housing in this country. And so that is going to always create homeless situations.
Even though the school district helped Chantille get into her new home, she says the rent, $1,800 per month, is far from affordable.
I can't really afford the amount of rent that's here, but I work hard enough every day. And I know that at any point, if I fall behind, the school told me that they're here for me.
The lack of affordable housing remains the biggest obstacle for low-income families like Chantel's to overcome, and that's not something a single law or school district can fix. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Illinois Newsroom is a public media collaboration covering education, politics, health, and the environment. We're out of time for this episode. Join us next week for another edition of Statewide. Be sure to go to our website, statewideshow.com. You can find links to all the stories we bring you. And a reminder, you can also find our podcast at NPR One. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.